Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Bhutang dhammang sanghang namassami. So as many of you know, on the second Sunday of each month, we read out one of the suttas, the original word of the Buddha, so you can understand what the Buddha actually taught, and you can compare it with what we say here on a Friday or on a Saturday to make sure that we're all keeping to the original teachings of the Buddha. And there are many different types of suttas. This particular one is some beautiful teachings on meditation. Given to the Buddha's son, Rahula. For those of you who don't remember the story, when the Buddha was got married to his princess Yasodhara, they had one son, and just after his son was born, that was when the Buddha left home to become a monk. And later on, when he returned home, his wife saw him, as now he was a monk, fully enlightened a Buddha, and his wife, ex-wife, the mother of his son, told Rahula, go to your father and ask for your inheritance. So he went to the Buddha, and the Buddha said, okay, I'll give you your inheritance. You ordained him as a monk. That's the inheritance. And so Rahula became a little novice, and obviously that this is one of the teachings which they gave this special person in a Sangha. Again, teachings of meditation. So here we go. Hope you've got the page there, ready to go. Thus have I heard. On one occasion, the Blessed One was living at Sarvati in Jeta's Grove, Anathapindika's Park. Then when it was morning, the Blessed One, dressed and taking his bowl and outer robe, went into Sarvati for alms, the alms round. The Venerable Rahula, also dressed and taking his bowl and outer robe, followed closely behind the Blessed One. So just following his worldly father, now his spiritual father, into the village for alms. Then the Blessed One looked back and addressed the Venerable Rahula thus, Rahula, any kind of material form whatever, whether past, future or present, internal or external, gross or subtle, inferior or superior, far or near, all material form should be seen as it actually is with proper wisdom thus. This is not mine. This I am not. This is not myself. That's a classic teaching of the Buddha that was first said in his second sermon in Anattalakkhana Sutta, the teaching on non-self. So we're talking about material form, whatever. Now what type of material form do you think he's talking about? He's talking about his body, possessions for a monk, your bowl and robe for a layperson, your money, your house, your car, all of your goods. And all of your friends and relations, all that material bit of them, their bodies, say it's not me, not mine, not a self. And that's standard description of non-self, what anatta means. It's not me. So you never think of yourself, I am a monk, I am a lay person, I am old, I am young, I am a man, I am a woman. Because that's taking this body to be me. It's much better, much closer to think of your body as just a vehicle which you happen to be driving. And no more would you say, I am a Honda, I am a Ferrari, I am an old bomb, if you just drive an old bomb of a car. That's just something you happen to have for the time being. So you never even say, I am Sri Lankan, I am Australian, I am Thai, I am Singaporean, I am Malay, or Chinese, or whatever. That is just your body. So I don't know why, especially all the Singaporeans here, are all so concerned about how their cricket team does. You're not Sri Lankan. You're not Australian, you just happen to have a Sri Lankan body this lifetime. But nevertheless, sometimes it's good fun, especially when they win. But we don't say this is me, nor do we say it is mine. Your body, as you should all know, is only on temporary loan from the earth. Came from the earth, it will go back there afterwards. And it's not in your control. So even this body does not belong to you, not me, not mine. It's not a self. The material form, you know, that can't be your essential being. And he's telling Rahula this, to not be materialistic and so caught up with your so-called possessions, because you don't own anything, really. Certainly not material stuff. It all will have to go. Any questions on that? So he's not messing around. He's telling, this is a monk's talk, telling it right to his son. And his son replies, only material form, blessed one, only material form, sublime one, material form, Rahula, and feeling, and perception, and formations, and consciousness. Now what that means is the five khandhas, the way we split up this body and mind into five things which completely cover everything mental, everything physical, without anything remaining outside of these five khandhas. That's why they have these five khandhas. Split up this way, that way, that way, so we can analyze these things separately. The feeling is that quality of sensory experience, of pleasure, or pain, or somewhere in between. And each sense has a different word to describe those pleasurable or unpleasant experiences. For example, with sight, it's beautiful or it's ugly. If it's with sound, the sense of hearing, it's either sort of sonorous or dissonant. If it's smell, it's stinky or it's fragrant. If it's taste, it's delicious or it's yucky. And feeling, with the body, it's usually pain or pleasure. But that same quality, which is in beauty, sonorous, fragrant, tasty, or pleasure of the body, that same positive part of that experience, that's called what we call sukha, a happy feeling. And the unpleasant part of every sensory experience, you know, the ugliness, the dissonance, the stinkiness, the, you know, bad taste, the yuckiness, the pain, all that negative part is what is called the dukkha feeling, the dukkha vedana, the unpleasantness of sensory experience. And that's what we call, if you like, just happiness and pain, or happiness and suffering, if you like. And the Buddha is saying here that you don't own that. That's not you. So when you experience suffering, don't be suffering. When you experience happiness, don't think, at last, that's the real me. Why? Because you can't control these things. You may have been trying, ever since you were born, to try and control your pleasure and pain. How many of you have succeeded? I haven't. Pleasure and pain, they come according to their own causes and conditions. They're out of control, which means they don't belong to me. Or as you might say in meditation, none of my business. Wouldn't it be wonderful to be able to do that? Completely let go of pleasure and pain and be independent. It's not me. It's not mine. It's certainly not a self. The wonderful thing here, it's only abbreviated here, but this is all feeling, whether past, future or present, internal or external, gross or subtle, inferior or superior, far or near. I like the inferior or superior. Even the most superior of happinesses, the bliss of the deep meditations, none of my business. I know that sometimes some people, if they haven't been well informed about the Buddha's teaching, you may get into a deep meditative experience and think, wow, that's it, I'm enlightened, that's God, that's nirvana, because it's very powerful, very beautiful, but that's not you, nothing to do with you, comes and goes. Any questions about that? Perceptions. The perceptions which you have is what you add on to reality. That's my friend, that's my enemy. That's what I like, that's what I don't like. All those perceptions which give a quality to your experience, the black, white and yellow, the heat and cold, and stuff like that. The stuff which we add on to reality to make it comprehensive to ourselves and to others, comprehensible rather, to ourselves and others. All that perception business. Have you ever had wrong perceptions? With all perceptions, you select only some qualities of the experience in front of you to neglect other qualities. If you look at a person, you look at their gender, you miss everything else about them. So perceptions are selective. That's not you. That's not who you are. That's not yourself. You know that sometimes in some traditions, they take what we call raw perception. Before you think, and they assume that that's somehow real. The bare perception of reality they take to be truth. But Buddhist psychology knows by the time that that perception gets to your brain, it's already been filtered and changed. It's been interpreted by your conditioning. Which is why this morning when we had breakfast, Ren Sheng, he had noodles, I had toast. I looked at his noodles and thought, yuck, that looks terrible. And I didn't say, but he looked at my toast and think, bleh, how can you eat that in the morning? Who was right? These are just perceptions, that's all. Nothing to do with reality. Just pure conditioning, and that's all it is. So you don't own your perceptions. So next time you have your dinner this evening, and you think, wow, that's delicious. Ask yourself, is it? Is it really delicious? Or is that just what you're adding on to reality? Or if your wife cooks something disgusting tonight, is it really yucky? Or is that what you're adding on to what you're experiencing? If you're really a Buddhist, this evening, a Buddhist girl here, make something yucky for your husband tonight. And tell him, today Ajahn Brahm said you can't say yucky or delicious. It's just food, that's all. Maybe don't do that. You get divorced and come and bother me. But you can see what we're talking about. That's perceptions. Any problem about that? The next one, sankharas. These are the mental formations. In particular, it includes things like thinking. All your thoughts. Why is it that we get our thinking and we make that important? This is me, this is mine, this is the self. Do you make yourself from your thoughts? Do you worry about your thoughts? Nice thoughts, stupid thoughts, deviant thoughts. Remember these thoughts, they're not you, not a self. Nothing to do with you, not mine. None of your business. For those of you meditators, next time you meditate and a thought comes in your mind, just say, none of my business. And then the thoughts stop. And then it becomes silent. But even more important than thought, in this category of mental formations, the main central character is your will, choice, intention. And the Buddha is saying here very clearly, intention, any kind of intention or will, whether past, future or present, internal or external, gross or subtle, inferior or superior, far or near, all will should be seen as it actually is with proper wisdom nouns. This is not mine. This is not me. This is not a self. So every time you see will appearing in your consciousness, when you see the process of choice, never think it's your choice or it's your will. This is an empty process. Going according to causes. You are, deeper than you think, out of control. And as soon as you realize that, the happier you will be. You're free. So this will, it just comes and goes, nothing to do with me. It's not me, not a self, it's not mine. It's nothing which you control. It's interesting afterwards, say, where does this will come from? And that's a fascinating thing to see. And lastly, probably even more important, consciousness, the knower, that which is listening to me, that which knows the thoughts, the mindfulness, the awareness. And it's nice, it says, consciousness, every type of, any kind of consciousness, whether past, future or present, internal or external, gross or subtle, inferior or superior, even cosmic consciousness, because it says all types of consciousness, God consciousness, every consciousness, is seen as it actually is with proper wisdom. This is not me. This is not mine. This is not a self. Even your consciousness does not belong to you. Nothing to do with you. Consciousness is none of your business. Da-da. How many of you understand that? If you did, you would be fully enlightened. We'd have a bunch of arahats here. That's a tough teaching. And it starts right in the beginning, because that was the teaching which enlightened the first five disciples of the Buddha. When they really got their heads into that, wow, it's true. There's nothing left to own. They became ownerless, empty beings. Arahats. Any comments or questions about that? Yes. Correct. If you understood this, you would wake up. But it's hard to understand that. Because some of it is counterintuitive. That's why you have to keep on at it many, 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 many times as a monk. To teach until the message gets in. Because intuitively you think, at least I'm the one who decides what I do with my life. I'm the one who decides to ask that question. I'm the one who knows. I'm the one who hears this. I'm the one who sees. I'm the one who's felt my body and experienced my life up to this point. And that's the illusion which the Buddha cracked. He said, are you? Remember, a lot of delusions come from not questioning what we take on face value to be truth. But we question these very deep things. And are you the knower? Are you the doer? You question that. And there's a lot of scientific evidence which, you know, from neurology, neuroscience, which actually points in the same direction the Buddha pointed to. All this will business is just a process. And all this consciousness is just a process as well. But it appears to us that this is me. I am the one who decided to come here. I am the one who speaks. I am the one who hears, knows and feels. And that is a big delusion. One of the ways of cracking that, obviously, it's through the power of meditation. You get so deep in meditation, when things disappear, then these solid things which you always took to be yourself vanish. That blows you away. That cannot have been me when you vanish. Imagine you're just sitting there, and then the person sitting next to you looks at you, and you disappear. You vanish. You know, you just puff. It's gone. That would really freak everybody out if you just vanished like that out of thin air. And then you just came back again. They think you sound like Superman or Invisible Man or one of these people in the movies. But that's precisely what happens in meditation with the mind. Things which should not disappear vanish. Things which you thought were solid seem to be vacuous and empty. So Buddha starts off there with a powerful deep teaching. Remember, this is to his son, so he wants to give him his inheritance, the Dharma liberation. It's true, if you really saw that deeply, where could there be any suffering? Well, there's no one there, no one to suffer. Yes. Aha. Aha. Remember what it says here? All will. Any time, any kind, whatever, past, future, present, internal or external, gross or subtle, inferior or superior, far or near, all will should be seen. So the Buddha's very sort of comprehensive in covering all his bases, even an external will. Even that is not you, not self, just a process. Both are purely conditioned. So this is very extreme. Totality of all will is a process, not coming from a being. Certainly not coming from an intelligent being like a God or an Allah or cosmic consciousness. But just the causal process. That's a fascinating thing to experience. That's why in deep meditation all will ceases. Everything goes. That's why in deep meditation it absolutely still can't move. And that's sort of what I'm saying about something which is always there disappearing. But this is what the Buddha said. And even all consciousness, which is the other sort of place where people get hung up on, it says all consciousness, unmanifest consciousness, which is one of those words which the Buddha, which has been translated wrongly, and which people say, ah, there is an unmanifest consciousness, an original mind, an essential consciousness, which is outside of these khandhas. He said, can't do that if you're true to the Buddha's teachings. He says all consciousness, including all mind consciousness. Internal, external, past, future or present, gross or subtle, inferior or superior, far or near, all should be seen. Not me, not mine, not a self. So there's nothing left. I'll continue. Then the Blessed One Then the Venerable Rahula considered thus, who would go into town for alms today when personally admonished by the Blessed One? At least he understood enough of those teachings to value them so much. How can you think of worldly things like eating when you got such a powerful deep teaching from the Buddha himself? So if you really understood this teaching, you wouldn't want dinner tonight. How can you have dinner this evening when you've heard such an amazing, wonderful teaching? Well, I'm sure you probably will have dinner tonight. Thus he turned back and sat down at the root of a tree, folding his legs crosswise, setting his body erect, and establishing mindfulness in front of him. Not in front of his nose. And in front of him, you might have heard me say before, that means just making mindfulness important. Giving it priority. The English word priority, making it prior, making it in front. That's what this word means, purakata. Making it in front. In other words, giving it priority. So when you start meditating, establish mindfulness first. Know where you are. Be in a moment. Be a bit silent so you establish mindfulness here and now, first of all. Then the Venerable Sariputta saw him sitting there and addressed him thus. So Sariputta, the Buddha's right-hand monk, Rahula, develop mindfulness of the breathing. When mindfulness of breathing is developed and cultivated, it brings great fruit and great benefit. So he just mentioned mindfulness of the breath to Rahula. However, he didn't actually explain what mindfulness of breathing was and why it's a great benefit. So then when it was evening, the Venerable Rahula rose from meditation, went to the Blessed One. After paying homage to him, he sat down on one side and asked the Blessed One, Venerable Sir, how is mindfulness of breathing developed and cultivated so that it is of great fruit and great benefits? Now, we seem to have almost a digression here, because the Buddha teaches him some basics, first of all. But before we go into the basics of the four great element meditations, any comments or questions? It's great to interrupt. Yes. Yeah. Yeah. very positive twist, because it's actually one of the monastic rules. If you're a novice monk and you misbehave, like if it was like a novice monk in my monastery and they misbehave, there's no way I could punish them. And it's specifically stated I couldn't make them fast and give up their food for the day. So, you know, you're not supposed to punish people in Buddhism. And sometimes some monks, that is, little novices ordaining with the big monks, they're naughty little kids. So the monk said, okay, you know, you're going to fast for a day. And the Buddha said, no, you shouldn't do that. Not that type of punishment. You can't beat them or hit them. I don't think you even so send them to their room and lock the door. So this idea of punishment is an admonition, but it's not an admonition in the sense of like a punishment. It's not bawling them out. It's always a positive admonition. And the commentary is, sometimes the commentary gets it right. Most times I think it gets it wrong. In this particular case, I'm sure that Rahula was sharp enough, being the Buddha's son, to have actually understood that that was a very, very deep teaching. And that was consistent with other stories about sometimes you can get such a deep teaching straight away that things like eating don't make any sense. You just want to go off and meditate somewhere. You're inspired and peaceful. It turns you away from the world and the gross things. Yeah. Correct. Correct, because the Buddha would not have been allowed to punish his son. Oh yeah, no, because it goes against the Vinaya. You're not allowed to punish a person by stopping them eating. You're not allowed to punish them in any way. Sending them out of the monastery is one way you can do it, but you can't stop them eating. So, we have the four great elements. Meditations, which we don't usually talk about, but this is almost like a reflection rather than a meditation. Rahula, whatever internally belongs to oneself, which is solid, solidified, and clung to, and clung to means it's just, it's accumulated on your body. That is, hairs of the head, hairs of the body, nails, teeth, skin, flesh, sinews, bones, bone marrow, kidneys, heart, liver, diaphragm, spleen, lungs, large intestines, small intestines, contents of the stomach, feces, or whatever else internally belongs to oneself is solid, solidified, and clung to. This is called the internal solid or earth element. Now, both the internal earth element and the external earth element are simply earth element. In other words, just material. And it should be seen as actually is with proper wisdom thus. This is not mine. This is not myself. This I am not. When one sees it thus as it actually is with proper wisdom, one becomes disenchanted. Actually, not disenchanted is one translation of this word nibbida. But I think in the next edition of this, Bhikkhu Bodhi did follow my suggestion. Nibbida is something much more than disenchanted. One's always turned off from the earth element and makes the mind dispassionate towards the earth element. So what that means is you look at your own body, other people's body, and you think, and especially Rahula, a young man, he sees a beautiful girl come in. What do you see? Just see hair of the head, hair of the body, nails, teeth, skin, sinews, bones, bone marrow, kidney, heart, liver, diaphragm, spleen, lungs, large intestines, small intestines. If you really fall in love with her, you think, oh, what beautiful small intestines you've got, my darling. Of course, you never say things like that. It's all about the external stuff. And if you actually see it as it truly is, what's there to have lust for? And the same with your own body. What's there to be so concerned about with your own body? It's just hair and bones and stuff. If you see it as actually is with proper wisdom, this is not mine, this is not you, this is not the self, you just get turned away from these bodies, disenchanted, not caught up with them anymore. Just a body, that's all. Just having one body is enough. Having two bodies, in other words, getting married, and then having another body, three bodies, four bodies, isn't one body enough to worry about? What Rahula is the water element. The water element may be either internal or external. What is the internal, like liquid element? Whatever internally belonging to oneself is water, watery, made up in your body clung to. That is bile, phlegm, pus, blood, sweat, fat, tears, grease, spittle, snot, all of the joints, urine, or whatever else in turn belongs to oneself is water, water we incline to. This is called the internal water element. Now both the internal water element and the external water element are simply water or liquid, and that should be seen as actually as with populism. Thus, this is not mine, this I am not, this is not myself. When one sees it thus as actually as with proper wisdom, one becomes disenchanted with the water element and makes the mind dispassionate towards the water element. So it's just water, that's all. Which is why that, for many years when I was in Thailand, you used to drink your own urine. It's supposed to be healthy for you. It's just urine, that's all. It's actually after a while became quite tasty, it's quite salty. Really quite nice. Are you grossed out about that? If you really sort of saw your water element, just water element, that's all, why don't you try drinking your own urine tonight? Or tomorrow morning? Are you repulsed by it? Why? It's just water element, that's all. So very healthy. The only reason I stopped was when I came to Australia. And we were just working so hard in that monastery down at Serpentine. I was sweating so much during the day, I had nothing left to drink. So I had to drink water instead. So after in the hot season, I just gave up and just got out of the habit of doing it. Anyway, that's just the water element. The fire element. The fire element by either internal or external. What is the internal fire element? Whatever internally belonging to oneself is fire, fiery and clung to. That is that by which one is warmed, ages and is consumed. It's a very interesting part of Asian ideas, that the fire is actually what ages you. Which is why I always say, you know, if you go in cold countries, people tend to live longer. Just the same way as you put things in the refrigerator, it lasts much longer. Maybe. They say the heat sort of makes you age. So maybe, following that sort of Asian idea, if you have a very, very hot temper, then you age very quickly. If you're very cool-headed and cool-hearted, then you age slowly. So those people who want anti-aging treatments, you've come to the right place. You keep nice and cool. So the heat element drops down if you age slowly. And it's also that by which what is eaten, drink, consumed and tasted gets completely digested. I always say that if you have a very hot sort of digestion, digestion goes very quickly. Too cold and you get indigestion. Interesting ideas. Or whatever else internally belonging to oneself is fire, fire and clung to. This is called the internal fire element. Now both the internal and external fire element are simply fire element. And that should be seen as ashes with proper wisdom. Thus, this is not mine, this I am not, this is not myself. And one becomes disenchanted or dispassionate or turned off by the fire element and makes the mind dispassionate towards the fire element. And what, Rahula, is the air element? The air element may be either internal or external. What is the internal air element? Whatever internally belonging to oneself is air, airy and clung to. That is the upgoing winds, the downgoing winds. Well, that's actually an Indian idea, Indian medicine idea. Very simple to the, similar to the qi in Chinese medicine. These aren't supposed to be actually air going through, but like flows of energy through the body. The winds going through your body. And he always used to say when those winds going through the body are unbalanced, that's where you get sicknesses from. In the same way when the qi is not balanced through the body, that's where you get the imbalance of the body causing sicknesses in Chinese medicine. This is ancient Indian medicine. They use the idea of winds flowing up and down the body. Or something similar which feels like that. Or whatever this is, winds. The upgoing and downgoing winds, winds in the belly, winds in the bowel, winds that course through the limbs, in-breath and out-breath, or whatever else internally belonging to oneself is air, airy and clung to. This is called the internal air element. Now both the internal air element and the external air element are simply air. And that should be seen as actually as with proper wisdom. Thus, this is not mine, this I am not, this is not myself. When one sees it thus, as it actually is with proper wisdom, one becomes disenchanted with the air element and makes the mind dispassionate towards the air element. We continue with the space element. What, Rahula, is the space element? The space element may be either internal or external. What is the internal space element? Whatever internally belonging to oneself is space, spatial, and clung to, that is, the holes of the ears, the nostrils, the door of the mouth, and that aperture whereby what is eaten, drunk, consumed, and tasted gets swallowed, and where it collects, and where it is secreted from below, or whatever else internally belonging to oneself is space, spatial, and clung to, this is the internal space element. Now both the internal and the external space element are simply space element, and that should be seen as actually, as with proper wisdom, this is not mine, this I am not, this is not myself. When one sees it thus as actually, as with proper wisdom, one becomes disenchanted with the space element and makes the mind dispassionate towards the space element. Now here, all you've done is these five elements here, so the earth, air, fire, water, and space. So just looking at the human body and other people's body and other material things. This is just the ancient way of categorizing material form in these five ways, just to make sure that people analyze it, and through analysis you see there's nothing there which is really worth clinging to. When you take things apart, you see a car is just made out of parts, the body is just made out of parts. No, it's just, that's all it is. So it means you see it as it truly is, and therefore you can let go of your attachment to the body. And I've gone through that quite quickly, because the next part gets something really nice and very practical, where the Buddha takes his basic teachings and just turns it into a way which is relevant to each one of us. But first of all, a question from Chris. Yeah, but I think this is more a reflection than a concentration, not a sort of a stillness of the mind, but a way of using the thinking, contemplative, reflective process, but with a framework which can see deeper into the nature of things. There's many ways of reflecting. One can reflect on the beauty of somebody, you know, which means when you see a beautiful girl, you look for that part of the girl which you like, and you ignore all the other parts which are not so delightful. But here, you're just analysing your human body completely, as thoroughly as you possibly can, using the framework of, in this case, the five elements, to see, it's just elements, that's all. Whether it's, what's that name of that? Oh, yeah, whether it's Paris Hilton, or whether it's Dracula, or whatever else is the ugliest person. And I saw in the newspapers, I never see them on these TV, the Ugly Betty. There's Ugly Betty, or Paris Hilton. They're just a bunch of earth element, fire element, wind element, liquid element, and space element, that's all. So it doesn't really matter, they're not sort of ugly or beautiful, they're just beings, that's all. It's both. Because you think that this should be quite obvious, but because it goes against what one wants to look at, one wants to be excited by beautiful objects. You might see yourself, you know, in a sort of a shopping mall, turning away from the ugly old ladies and looking at the pretty young ones. Why do you do that? And the point is that that's our character, that's our inclination to go for the beauty, the delightful. And in order to overcome that, we first of all do need to sort of reflect. But the only way the reflection can be really deep is that we have a degree of stillness. We can go against our old habits and our resistance to see something which is more liberating. But a lot of time, the way we lose contemplation, we contemplate to see what we want to see, to hear what satisfies us, rather than seeing the big picture. So a bit of concentration gives you the freedom from your desire and ill will to see things more deeply. And because you see things more deeply, it makes it easier to meditate. So you can't say it comes before, it comes after. It's done sort of as a support and as a consequence of the concentration. Yeah. Yeah.
Why is there such a design?
reason is because why people do that, the reasons behind why one looks for what is delightful, is because the mind seeks for happiness. It eats happiness. It depends upon joy. And it will look for happiness wherever it can find it. If it can't find it anywhere else in reality, it will find it in delusion. Which is why many people might spend hours and hours and hours and hours watching the TV, the soap operas, the movies, or anything else. They know it's fantasy, but at least it's fun. I remember one person once quoted, and I liked the quote because at least he was being honest, although I disagree with him totally. He said, fantasy is much more delightful than real life. And that's why people get into fantasy, because real life is very difficult. The real partner, you know what she looks like. But in the glossy magazines, all that's airbrushed out. And in the movies, they're just all supermodels, hunks, whatever. So a lot of times we see that because that's what we want to see, because it satisfies our desire for happiness. And if we can't find happiness in another area, we'll just go for the ordinary stuff. The mind needs joy. It will incline towards joy wherever it can find it. If it can't find it in reality, it will find it in fantasy. Great, yeah. Indeed. You add so much onto what you see. Which is why, and I remember reading a Chinese book about, I think Lucidius Hearn or something. There's a nice little story about this prodigy in Imperial China. This boy who was just so clever, and he could learn anything, he was great at Mandarin, great at poetry, great at calligraphy. And because he was such a clever kid, a prodigy, he came to the notice of the emperor, invited him to the court, and the emperor realized this fellow would be a great asset to the empire, so he took him on as almost like his son, and gave him the best tutors and people to educate him. And he was always really concerned about his progress. When he got to about 17 or 18, he disappeared from a couple of weeks from work, from the court. And the emperor said, "Where's he gone?" And his minister said, "Oh, he's fallen in love." And the emperor thought, "Oh, a 17, 18-year-old girl, that's just what happens. Boy, that's what happens to a boy. They fall in love." But he said, "Wow, this guy is so intelligent. He's so clever, and his prospects are so good. He's going to be very wealthy. You know, he's basically my son. That girl must be beautiful. I really want to see the girl he's fallen in love with, because he can have any girl he wants in the whole of China." And so the emperor wanted to find out just how beautiful this girl was, and so summoned the girl and his adopted son into the court. And this girl was just so ordinary and plain. The emperor thought, "Gee, what's he doing? He's so intelligent in everything else in life, and he's fallen in love with this ordinary-looking girl." And his minister said, "Yes, what it's like when you fall in love. You only see part of what's there, what you think is beautiful, and you're just blind to everything else." I always remember that story, because that's so true to life. If you've ever fallen in love, especially a man, the girl is the most beautiful and amazing. You just can't believe that, she's going out with you. And all these other men have lost the most beautiful girl in the whole of Perth. And she thinks, "Wow, he's the best guy in the whole of Perth. I'm so lucky to have him." And the girl thinks, "What, him? Come on, get real. Oh no, he's so beautiful, so wonderful." Delusion, that's what happens. Now that's an extreme. But a lot of times, maybe not going to that extreme, so we're going halfway to that extreme with what we look at a person. So anyway, let's get on this. The next part is really useful. This is very practical. Yeah, Hugh? Yeah, great, because she's added one in here. So it's the title there which is wrong. Sometimes they say six great elements, because sometimes you have the four, the earth, air, fire and water, and they add onto that sort of space and sometimes consciousness. And sometimes added here, you've got five. So really that's the title there in brackets. They should have put five. Five elements. Okay, now this is a nice one. I love this passage here. Rahula, having done this of the standard elements, develop meditation that is like the earth. How do you do earth meditation? Here. For when you develop meditation that is like the earth, arisen agreeable and disagreeable contacts will not invade your mind and remain. Just as people throw clean things and dirty things excrement, urine, spittle, pus and blood on the earth. And the earth is not horrified, humiliated and disgusted because of that. So too, Rahula, develop meditations like the earth. For when you develop meditations like the earth, arisen agreeable and disagreeable contacts will not invade your mind and remain. So people throw blood, spittle, shit on you. The earth doesn't complain. Well, it doesn't. The earth doesn't smile when you put flowers and fragrances and beautiful stuff on the earth. So it can be like the earth. People call you a shit stick, or they call you the most wonderful monk in the whole of the planet. Be like the earth, so you don't move. That's the earth meditation. I really love that. So why don't you be like the earth, do the earth meditation. So whatever your husband says, whatever your wife does, jumping up and down, just like the earth. Develop meditation is like water. For when you develop meditation that is like water, arisen agreeable and disagreeable contacts will not invade your mind and remain. Just as people wash clean things and dirty things, excrement, urine, spittle, pus, blood and water, and the water is not horrified, humiliated, disgusted because of that. So too, Rahula, develop meditation that is like the water. For when you develop meditation that is like water, arisen agreeable and disagreeable contacts will not invade your mind and remain. So in English we say just go with the flow. Don't resist it. Someone calls you stupid. Yes, go with the flow. Just like water washes everything, clean things and dirty things, just when you're like the water, nothing in the whole world horrifies you or disgusts you, or even delights you. Clean things, dirty things, you're at peace with everything. It's this beautiful open mind, where nothing sticks and makes you rattled. Develop meditation that is like the fire. For when you develop meditation that is like the fire, arisen agreeable and disagreeable contacts will not invade your mind and remain. Just as people being burned, clean things and dirty things, excrement, urine, spittle, pus and blood in the fire, and the fire is not horrified, humiliated and disgusted because of that, so too, Rahula, develop meditation that is like the fire. For when you develop meditation that is like fire, arisen agreeable and disagreeable contacts will not invade your mind and remain. Develop meditations like air, for when you develop meditation that is like air, arisen agreeable and disagreeable contacts will not invade your mind and remain. Just as the air blows on clean things and dirty things, on excrement, urine, spittle, pus and blood, and the air is not horrified, humiliated and disgusted because of that, so true, Rahula. Develop meditation that is like the air, for when you develop meditation that is like the air, arisen agreeable and disagreeable contacts will not invade your mind and remain. Rahula, develop meditation that is like space. For when you develop meditation that is like space, arisen agreeable and disagreeable contacts will not invade your mind and remain. Just as space is not established anywhere. So too, Rahula, develop meditation that is like space. For when you develop meditation that is like space, arisen agreeable and disagreeable contacts will not invade your mind and remain. So a space can contain anything. And it's always big enough to contain every experience which you have without being humiliated, crushed, or disgusted. So when you experience great pain or disappointment, things don't go your way. Be like the elements. The elements don't complain. They're not disgusted, humiliated. That way you can have the equanimity which comes from developing the contemplation or the meditation on here, the five great elements. So I don't know if you have any difficulties in life. If you do, remember those five elements. So I'm just going to be like the earth, be like water, like fire, like air, or my favorite one, be like space. People call me an idiot. There's room in my mind to accept that. People call me stupid. There's room in my mind to accept that. So you can accept anything without rejecting anything. So you never get moved. There's plenty of space left. Yes. Oh yeah, because a kasina is more for a focusing of the mind. The Kasina meditations, which are on sort of usually simple objects like the discs, that is basically for developing a powerful still mind. This is actually developed for getting rid of those agitations of the mind caused by contact, especially unpleasant contact with worldly phenomena like speech, experience, life, situations. Remember, this is all about how to develop the meditation on the breath. So what the Buddha is actually going through the preliminaries first of all. So, you know, just a body, that sort of four elements, don't worry about it and stop having all these lustful fantasies because they're just about other bodies, that's all. And if there's any upset or anger about what somebody's done to you, just be like the five elements of earth, air, fire, water and space. So earth doesn't get upset, so why should you get upset? So it's a great practice on equanimity. Now the thing is, you don't have to get upset. It's just bad habits of our culture. Someone calls you stupid and you think you have to stand up for your rights. It's really standing up for your wrongs, not the rights. So I don't know why people do that. You just let it go. Never allow anybody to control your happiness. Just because they say, I'm an idiot or stupid or you're ugly or whatever, I'm not going to allow that to upset me. I don't have to respond. Well, the Buddha said, if somebody gives you a gift and you don't accept it, then the gift stays with the donor. So if someone gives you the gift of calling you an idiot and I don't accept it, then the idiot tag stays with them. So I don't need to respond. I can be like the earth. Like fire, like water. Great meditation. And of course that means you get really quiet and peaceful because nothing to think about, nothing to worry about, nothing to agitate you. Comments on that? It's a really great part of this sutta. Now we go further. Rahula, develop meditation on loving kindness. For when you develop meditation on loving kindness, any ill will will be abandoned. Any ill will. It doesn't mean just loving kindness on people or persons. It's on things. In the same way, you know, we don't just like love this person or that person. We can love a cup of tea, or we can love the weather, or we can love peace. In the same way, you can hate. You can hate your body, you can hate your mind, you can even hate your meditation cushion. And it's your meditation cushion, it's always lumpy. You can never get it right, so you kick your meditation cushion. The one TV show which I did see, with 40 Towers, because one of the people I went to school with, he was Manuel. I mentioned this before, Manuel did not come from Barcelona, he lived in Chiswick. I know that because I grew up with him. He was a waiter, but apparently in one of these episodes of 40 Towers, I think, who is it? John Cleese, that's right, John Cleese, the owner of the hotel. He was in his car and it broke down. He got so upset with his car, he got out a stick, started beating the car. Not the first time, I told you, I warned you, whack, 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 and don't ever do this again. He hated his car. He thought the car did it on purpose. It was a very funny scene. And the reason it was funny, because that's what people do, they hate things. And they, as if that these things have got it in for you. You kick the car or you kick the cat because you're really upset. Not the cat's fault. The cat's just being a cat. So the reason we do that, ill will can be to things, not just to people. So we have loving kindness towards our mind, towards our meditation, loving kindness towards this moment. The door of my heart is open to whatever happens in this moment. Any mind state, any sound, even inanimate things. It's great to have loving kindness towards that. Develop meditation on compassion. For when you develop meditation on compassion, any cruelty will be abandoned. As a compassion is seeing the pain in other beings and feeling so sad that the pain which exists in life. If you really see pain and, you know, feel the pain of others and wish that pain to disappear, you can't add to pain with cruel, add to the existing pain by being cruel to others. People are hurting enough already. You don't want to add to their pain by being cruel to them or being unkind to them. In the same way, you are hurting enough already. So why add to your own existing dukkha by being tough on yourself and being cruel? And saying, come on me, get your meditation together. Come on, keep those precepts better. Come on, go to the temple more often. Or whatever it is you're supposed to be trying to do, please don't be cruel to yourself. There's enough pain in the world already without you adding to it. Develop the meditation on appreciative joy. For when you develop meditation on appreciative joy, any discontent will be abandoned. Usually appreciative joy, mudita, is about enjoying the successes of other people. What about enjoying your own successes? You're a person too. So you focus on all the wonderful things you've achieved so far. All your good and beautiful quantities. Like I say, when you're meditating, the very fact that you've actually got here, and you've got your legs crossed and you're meditating, sadhu, 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 it's a wonderful achievement. That's called appreciative joy. You are seeing your conduct, which you can appreciate and value. And then all this discontent of wanting something else, wanting something more, wanting to get into jhana, wanting to get enlightened, wanting to achieve more, all that discontent business goes. Appreciative joy is the same, basically, as gratitude. Of non-fault finding. Of a positive mind, which is really important for meditation. Remember, this is just getting this meditation set up right to begin with. And last, develop meditation on equanimity. For when the mind develop meditation on equanimity, any aversion will be abandoned. So equanimity means that whatever you experience in meditation, you're at peace with it. What I call making peace. The real meaning of equanimity is called upeka, which literally means just looking on. Just looking at it. Don't mind if it's nice, if it's not so nice, just leave it alone. Just make peace with it as it is. Don't try and change it. If you don't change anything, aversion disappears. Those are the four, what we call the four Brahma-viharas. Very great meditation tools, which here he's doing before he does the breath meditation. It's a great way of getting rid of these obstacles before you meditate. Any questions about those? It's a general rule of thumb to do the preparation well before you start the breath. And I wasn't taught that, and I was fortunate, I had good meditation to begin with, but some people struggle so hard with the breath. And they thought, okay, I just got to try harder to watch the breath, but they just couldn't do it. The reason they couldn't do it is because they didn't prepare their mind enough to begin with. They still had all this other stuff going on in there, which hadn't sort of settled down yet. No wonder they couldn't watch the breath. So our job, if you're going to meditate or teach meditation, then get people to be comfortable in their body first of all, to sit in a comfortable position, and get this mindfulness coming up, and then get all these major obstacles out of the way. You know, for me, I always teach like the past and the future, the biggest obstacles. And that's a lot of discontent, anger, ill will. Those five types of element meditation, that should get rid of a lot of the past anger and ill will. You just like the earth, I just let it go. And the four Brahma-viharas is another lovely way to get the mind sort of settled into a bit of kindness, a bit of non-cruelty, gentleness. What are they again? No cruelty, no ill will, no discontent, no aversion. It's a wonderful thing to lessen those first of all, so that when you watch the breath, all of those obstacles are pretty much dealt with. Yeah, sure, because... okay, you're asking that question. Will you spontaneously go towards something like the breath? If you've done these preliminaries, that certainly happens with me. So very often I never choose to watch the breath and just do the preliminaries, just start letting go and the breath just comes up. That may be because it's a habit of mine, I've done meditation for such a long time that almost like the mind knows what to do. It's automatic. I would always usually encourage new meditators to go look for the breath at a certain time. But I think after a while it does become habitual. There's a question over here somewhere. Yeah. Yet these are great mental preparations on a daily life to actually so that you don't get upset by what happens to you in this world. If you're sort of in a bit of trouble, just remember I'm going to be like the earth now. So maybe your boss at work is shouting at you. Then I'm going to imagine I'm the earth. Pour whatever shit you want on me, but I'm not going to react. Or you can have like the four Brahmaviharas, you know, so that you know, ill will, no cruelty, no discontent, no aversion. Especially the way I put it here, towards yourself. And so, you know, just be grateful just how good you already are. Instead of that sort of sympathetic joy, be sympathetic to yourself. You've already come a long way. Look for how far you've come. Don't look for how much of the journey is left. It gives you a lot of encouragement and inspiration that way. Now we've got Rahula, develop the meditational foulness. Because when you develop meditational foulness, any lust will be abandoned. And you know that a super meditation of foulness, I mentioned that every time we have a novice ordination here, we're going to have another novice ordination on March the 30th, I think, or 31st or something. And the foulness, when we say the novice during the ordination, they're taught about the hair of the head, hair of the body, nails, teeth and skin, because that's all dead matter. What you see, hair of the head, hair of the body, that's all dead hair, because the live stuff is underneath. The nails and the teeth, that's all dead. The roots are hidden, you can't see that. And even the skin on the surface is all dead stuff. The live part of the skin is underneath. On the outside, it's dead, it's flaking off, even now. So the Buddha used that. So whenever you see a person, all you see is the hair of the head, hair of the body, nails, teeth and skin. That's the external part of a person. That's what you see, and that's all dead. So I tell the novice, look, would you like to kiss and hug dead stuff? Yuck, no way. In other words, it's just to get rid of some of the lust. However, I know that some monks have got into a super meditation, they've gone too far. And just they've got really negative. And you've got to be careful here because, you know, some monks have got some strange attitudes towards life. Maybe that's why they became monks. I don't know. But certainly I've seen a few weirdos in my time. And they get really into this a super stuff and they go over the top. And everything is disgusting, terrible and disgusting. But interestingly, in my experience, those monks who really get into the asupa meditation, the disgust and the foulness of bodies, they don't usually last very long as a monk. They usually disrobe after a few years and go and get married. I think really what it's doing is they got lust and they just don't know how to deal with it in a proper way, and so they just overdo the foulness and it doesn't work. Anyway, that just, if you do ever have lust, if it's lust, it's, now this is also useful for those of you who are married. You know, that it's nature that, well, during your married life, you'll see someone else who's really beautiful or attractive. But you know, you've got your marriage vows, you've got your partner, and you do love them. So, in order to make sure you don't get into trouble, it's so easy to get into trouble if you're not careful. If you see someone, you know, you're already married, you see someone you like, be careful not to allow the mind just to focus on that part of their body, the part of the character which enhances the lust. Look for the other part of them, something which is more disgusting than the nice part, because you can choose. If she's got like nice hair, you can just go to her hair, but look for something which is not nice about her. That's what I did for many years as a monk, as a young monk. Whenever I saw a beautiful girl come in, I'd look for her pimples. That was my trick. And you know, I could always find a zit somewhere on her face. And that just was enough to say she's imperfect. And that really sort of lessened my lust. Yeah? Yeah. Yeah. But you know also that story in the suttas where the monks really got into the foulness when the Buddha went on a retreat and ended up committing suicide. And the Buddha said, look, you monks, you've gone too far. And he said, do better meditation instead. So people actually can get into that. And remember, this is like, for especially for monks, you know, and especially for young monks, when you first become a monk, you know, you've lived in the monastery for I don't know how many months, you know how difficult it is dealing with lust. And so this is like to help. But if you go too far, it doesn't work. You've just got to do the right amount of just seeing, you know, they're not sort of disgusting person. Now you use the disgust just to balance the lust, so you see them as they are. They're just a person deserving of compassion and respect. But not something you just want to curl up in bed with. So it's getting that balance right. Not you want to kill them. Yeah, they're so disgusting. I don't want to come in my monastery ever again. And that's actually what happens, you know, sometimes that in some religions, like women aren't even allowed in the temple when they're menstruating. That's disgusting. No, it should be the men should not be allowed to go in the temple when they're going through whatever. They had a wet dream the previous night or something, I don't know. That seemed to be fair. But, you know, that goes over the top in the Asupa. You've got to be careful not to do it too much. Otherwise, there's no respect. So those are the preliminaries, just to get the mind nice and even, to let go of some of the grosser burdens which we can be carrying into our meditation. Now we go to the breath meditation itself. After all this time, now we go to the meditation on the breath. Rahula, develop... Oh, they haven't finished, sorry. We didn't do the impermanence. This is a good one. Rahula, develop meditation on the perceptions of impermanence. For when you develop meditation on the perception of impermanence, the conceit I am will be abandoned. Ah, that's an amazing statement that. I missed that one out. Impermanence, things come, things go. Now you have a good meditation, now you have a bad meditation. Now you're alive, now you're dead, now you're bright, now you're sleepy, now you're clever, now you're stupid. Which one is the right me? I don't know. None of them are. There's this old story from Nasruddin. One of my favourite stories from this Iranian mullah. Years and years, these are Sufi stories. The Sufi was one part of Islam which was really nice. Up to a point. But this Nasruddin, he went to the fair with his students. He decided to give them a day out after working so hard on their spiritual practices. And in the fair, there was, you know, they have the coconut shies, you know, where you have a boy trying to hit the coconuts. This was like an archery store where you can buy 3 arrows, say for $1. And if you hit the target, you get the prize, like a big teddy bear or something. And so Nasruddin goes there with his students and gives $1 to the guy behind the counter and says, give me 3 arrows. And his student says, don't do it, don't do it. You know, you're a mullah, you're a priest. You don't know, you're not a soldier, you don't know how to shoot arrows. So I can do anything, said the mullah, like really proud and arrogant it seemed. And so they watched the first time they've ever seen. It's like if I took an arrow and sort of tried to shoot, be really interested. Can Ajahn Brahm shoot? Can he use his like psychic powers there to get the target? Or is he going to make a fool of himself? And so he took the first arrow, put it in the bow and shot it. And he went halfway to the target. It was absolutely incompetent. And his students, you know, started to say, get out of here quick, you know, you're embarrassing us and yourself. And of course everybody started to watch. And he turned around and said, that was a shot of a hasty man. And he put his next arrow in the bow. And this time he took his time and pulled it right back. And he shot it. And everyone was watching this time. It made a distance, but it was about a $10 train fare on the other side of the target. It was a long way distant. And people were starting to giggle. And all of his students were getting more and more embarrassed. And he said, that was a shot of an arrogant man. And then he put his last arrow in the bow, pulled it back and shot it. And people were just about going to fall over themselves laughing at the stupidity of this man who thought he could shoot arrows with no training at all. But that third arrow went right in the bullseye. And as he was getting his prize, they said, well, if the first shot was a shot of a hasty man, and the second shot was a shot of an arrogant man, what was that third shot? And he said, oh, that was me. And what that is actually showing is that we always think, when we do it right, oh, that was the real me. I was on form. I was my real self today, when you do it right. When you make mistakes, no, that wasn't really me. I was not in the right form. I was just tired. We always make excuses as if that wasn't really you when you made a mistake. But that was you when you made a mistake. That was you when you made it right. In a sense, you're always changing. So it's anicca. So that way you don't have to worry about success and failure. Sometimes you'll be successful, sometimes you will fail. Which one is the correct you? Neither of them are. Or all of them are, if you want. Doesn't that make you free? You are free to fail. And it's not you. Any comments or questions on that? Yeah. Yeah. Aha! Who knows? You can have to ask them. Oh yeah. The thing is, anyone who follows the Eightfold Path can get enlightened. It doesn't matter what you call yourself, it's what you do. But then again, you can argue that if anyone follows the Eightfold Path, they call themselves a Christian, a Muslim, a Jew, or whatever, if they follow the Eightfold Path, they're a Buddhist. So as a Buddhist, you're not a Buddhist because you say you're a Buddhist, it's what you do, whether you behave as a Buddhist. So they may call themselves a Christian, they may wear a cross, they may even wear a veil. But if they're following the Eightfold Path, they're a Buddhist. That's why you don't have to have initiation to be a Buddhist. It's not like you're baptized. Because actually, I was baptized as a Christian. When I was about 6 weeks old or something. My parents never asked me. That was really mean. But that didn't make me a Christian, just because you were baptized. So it's just the same way. Just calling yourself a Buddhist, does that make you a Buddhist? If you're circumcised, does that make you a Jew? Of course not. It's what you do makes you what you are. If they did, yes. Depends what they did. If they got into jhana, saw the Dhamma, practiced the Eightfold Path, then they could be enlightened. It's what you do, not who you think you are. Sorry? Yeah, they're called Pacheka Buddhists. Okay, now, the breath meditation. Here, Rahula. Rahula developed meditation on the breath, mindfulness of breathing. When mindfulness of breathing is developed and cultivated, it's a great food of great benefit. How is mindfulness of breathing developed and cultivated so it's a great food and great benefit? Here, Rahula, a monk, meditator, goes to the forest or to the root of a tree to an empty, not an empty heart, and it's an empty place. Sits down, having folded his leg crosswise, set his body erect, and establishes mindfulness as a priority. Ever mindfully breathes in, mindfully breathes out. Step number one. So it's just preparing yourself. Now we go to the first four stages. Breathing in long, you understand I breathe in long. Or breathing out long, you understand I breathe out long. Breathing in short, you understand I breathe in short. Breathing out short, you understand I breathe out short. That's steps 1 and 2, the 16 steps. It doesn't mean that now you breathe in long and now you breathe in short, because sometimes people say, how long or how short? How about breathing in the middle? It just means in the beginning, in order to anchor your attention on the breath, you can actually just ask yourself, is this long, is it short, is it middle? What type of breath is it? Is it rough or is it smooth? You can even count your breath. It's just to get your attention on the breath to begin with. He trains us. I shall breathe in experiencing the whole body of breath. He trains us. I shall breathe out experiencing the whole body of breath. Remember, you're breathing in, breathing out. You're focusing on the breath. And in the Anapanasati Sutra, it says specifically that the reason we call this as a body is the breath is because the breath is one of the bodies, according to Buddhism. And so anyone, I know there are some monks who keep saying, no, this third stage you've got to be aware of your physical feelings in the body. That is really bunkum. They can't really sustain that. And every meditator who's done any good meditation knows you have to let go of the body as soon as possible. So here you're experiencing the whole of the breath, the whole body of the breath, means from the very beginning of the in-breath to the end of the in-breath, the very beginning of the out-breath to the end of the out-breath, even the spaces in between, you know, the whole breath. So it's not just in-out, it's seeing the beginning of the in-breath and watching all to the end, seeing the gap between the breaths, and seeing the out-breath begin all the way to the end of the out-breath. That's what we mean by the full body of the breath. And then you train yourself, I shall breathe in, tranquilizing the body formation, which is the breath. I shall breathe out, tranquilizing the bodily formation. In other words, just relaxing the breath. That's what I've been saying recently. In the same way you relax the body. You know how to relax the body. See if you can relax the breath, which is the same reason as tranquilizing it, calming it down. So you've got this beautiful, first of all, you've got to know the breath fully before you can tranquilize it. You've got to capture the elephant before you can train it. So you capture the breath, know the breath fully, and then you calm it down. You relax it. Stage four. So you've got this beautiful relaxed breath, breathing in, breathing out, full awareness of the breath. What happens next? Number five, you should breathe in, experiencing rapture, breathe out, experiencing rapture, breathe in, experiencing pleasure, breathing out, experiencing pleasure. So here you are the experiences of the pleasure and the rapture. This is called the pithi sukha. This is the joy of meditation. Now this happens naturally once you relax your breath. In the same way when you relax the body, ah, that feels good. Same way you've been working really hard or going for a long run or a walk, and then you sit down in your chair. Ah, this feels very good. And that's the type of pleasure which begins with, just the ease of meditation. So you deliberately focus not on the breath now, but on the joy of the breath, the pleasure of it, the ease. And that's such an important part of the meditation. I focus on that a lot in my teachings, to get some pleasure up. So you're enjoying the meditation. And if that pleasure comes up, anyone who comes along and says, no, you're not supposed to experience pleasure, you'll just get attached to it, that is completely contrary to the Buddha's teachings, and that is also a huge obstacle to the success of meditation and enlightenment. This is a path of pleasure, but of mental pleasure, not a physical pleasure. And I shall breathe in, experiencing the mental formation, he trains thus. I shall breathe out, experiencing the mental formation. I shall breathe in, tranquilizing the mental formation. I shall breathe out, tranquilizing the mental formation. That mental formation is the pithi sukha itself. So experiencing the whole pithi sukha and then calming it down. So it just feels so light and so easy with this beautiful, delightful breath. Start with the delightful breath, the beautiful breath. The breath disappears and it's just the beauty is left. You're tranquilizing, settling it down. Until the time comes, the breath completely disappears and you're left with just the beauty. Now we get to the nice stages of meditation. Step number 9. I shall breathe in, experiencing the mind, the citta. I shall breathe out, experiencing the citta. Usually what happens when you calm the mind down to this stage, you see this beautiful light in the mind. It's called a nimitta. And again, just my own experiences for a long time, just wondering what that nimitta was, until you realize that that was a reflection of your mind. It's like looking at your mind in a mirror. It's only that deep, still state you can actually see that clearly. That is the stage of experiencing the citta, when you see the nimitta inside your mind. At that stage, the body has disappeared. You can hardly feel it. Sounds are just so distant. Thoughts are almost gone. They should be really gone by this time. So you're very, very still, very internal. See this beautiful light come up in the mind. I shall breathe in, gladdening the mind, breathe out, gladdening the mind, breathe in, concentrating the mind, breathe out, concentrating the mind. The gladdening means bring joy. Abhipramojayam is the word. I call that like shining up the nimitta, making it more brilliant, more bright, because that nimitta, to do its job, has to be beautiful and wonderful. And there's many ways of shining up that nimitta. The best way is being a pure-hearted, good, kind person who keeps his precepts and does lots of charity, really kind, very giving. Because that makes you have a bright, beautiful mind. And I've seen that the years I've taught meditation, when people get nimittas, I can predict now when a person gets a nimitta, if I've known them very well, what type of nimitta they will get. If they're really kind, generous, warm-hearted, never sort of criticize anyone, always very helpful, never really negative in any way, what we call pure-hearted people, when their nimitta comes up, oh, that's amazingly beautiful. If you're negative, fault-finding, grumpy, if you ever do get a nimitta, it's dark, stained, dirty. is you're actually seeing a reflection of your mind. And it's almost like an accumulation of what you've done over the last, especially over the last few weeks. So if you've been, this is where virtuous conduct, kindness, compassion, generosity, you really get its results here. You see, your mind is beautiful when it appears. However, for those people who've been messing around, there is a trick. If you get a nimitta coming up and it's not so nice, you can always focus on the beautiful part of it. There's always a beautiful part of every nimitta, a part which is less dirty and stained than the other parts. You focus on that, and that sort of grows in your field of attention. It expands, and then you go to the beautiful part of that beautiful part, and the beautiful part of that beautiful part. And that way, as you focus into the most beautiful part, you actually brighten up the nimitta. And that's called actually gladdening the mind. That's actually brightening up. It's bringing pamuja into that nimitta. Until the nimitta gets so incredibly shiny, brilliant, and beautiful. And concentrating the mind, samadhan. You all know that I don't like that word concentration. I prefer the word stillness. And this is very important in this stage. You're not concentrating that nimitta. You're keeping it still so it's not moving. It's stable. Instead of moving all over the place, it's just still, stable, beautiful. And that's the job of those two factors. And then liberating the mind means the mind falls into that nimitta, or nimitta envelops it. That's called the jhana. That's the 12th step. That's consistent with what the Buddha called the 8 liberations, all jhanas. When you come out afterwards to contemplate, you need to come out of the jhanas. You can't contemplate within any of these jhanas. You train thus, I shall breathe in, contemplating impermanence, breathe out, contemplating impermanence, breathe in, contemplating disappearing or fading away. I shall breathe out, contemplating fading away. I shall breathe in, contemplating cessation. I shall breathe out, contemplating cessation. I shall breathe in, contemplating relinquishment. I shall train thus, I shall breathe out, contemplating relinquishment. Remember, this is a sequence here. You've just come out of the jhanas. You do this at the end, one after the other. The impermanence, what was not there in the jhanas, which was there before, which was there afterwards. Your body, sound, thought, will, those are those things which weren't there in the jhanas. You contemplate the absence of things which were always there for you. In the same way that simile which I can't be, of the tadpole grown into a frog outside of the lake for the first time in its life, when it is outside of the lake, can know what water is. When you're in that lake, born in that lake, grown up in that lake, tadpole cannot know what water is. Even if it reads books, if it's a philosopher of water, still can't know unless it gets outside of that lake. And this is what the jhanas are, getting out of the lake of your body, your senses, thinking, will. Then you know what these things are. Because you see, they've disappeared. They've been impermanent. They've faded away. They've ceased. There's things which have ceased in there, which aren't there in the jhanas. And then relinquishing, which means not me, not mine, not a self. Having seen these can come and go, they're not yours, then you can let them go. Any comments on that before I get to the last paragraph? These are standard teachings of mine. You can read it in the books, yes? Yeah. Mental formation is the piti sukha. So you've got the beautiful breath, but this is really focusing on the beautiful part of the breath. And when you're sort of looking at anything, you'll be focusing on a number of possible features available to you. You can look at me, you can listen to my voice, or you can look at my glasses or my robes, but you're not really paying attention to those things. They're not important. So first of all, you've got the beautiful breath, and then you focus in particular on the beauty of that breath, the joy of it. So the breath just disappears. You're not really, that's not important anymore. It's done its job. It's the joy of the mind now you're focusing on. And the joy, yeah. Pleasant, yeah. So when people say, should you always be watching the breath? No, the breath has done its job at this point. Let the breath go and just enjoy the pleasure. Contemplation is done You need something to contemplate on, first of all. You need data. Now, you're a scientist. Now, you do your experiments, you get a whole list of data. Once the data's in, then you contemplate it. And you can see the patterns, work out what it means, to see its consequences. So number one, you need data, first of all. And number two, when you do contemplate these things, you've got to have a really fair mind, which is not looking for what you want to see in the data, and which is, you know, not in denial about what's obviously being said in that data. Many scientists, they don't see things because it goes against their intuition or their what they've been taught. And that's why sometimes these scientists, they come along with this thing, and they see this, and this is not what I've been taught. It doesn't make sense, but it's true. You know what was those two Nobel laureates in UWA who found out that bacteria which causes stomach ulcers? And for years, the scientific community would not accept that, even though the evidence was solid. So to contemplate data, you do need a mind which is, in Buddhism, free from the hindrances. No desire, no ill will, no restlessness, no sloth and torpor, no doubt. You see it with a clear mind. So contemplation, to be effective, needs these two things, the useful data and the ability to contemplate without any bias, either for or against. That's right, yes. It's a process of insight. No thinking, a bit of thinking maybe, but it has to be very thinking which is not under the influence of any defilements. That's right, yes. Maybe the teachings of Dhamma give you the framework, but what's more important is the data which you've got, plus the mind which is free to see things as they truly are, because they're not blocked by the hindrances. That's why they call them hindrances. They're blockages. You can't see what's true. Because of ill will, you don't want to see it. Because of desire, you want to see something else. Of course you do. You have to have jhanas. That's why you have to have Eightfold Path. That's why even the Sufis need the Eightfold Path to become enlightened. And the eighth fact of the Eightfold Path is always jhana. Always was, always will be. Correct. That's what the Buddha said. Yeah, some teachers say all you need to do is to believe in Jesus. I follow the Buddha. And it's very clearly said. I don't know why that happened. It's just the wind has just blown it off to number 64. Here we go. Just go to 64. Where has it gone here? Page. Where's it gone? Where's that one about the. Okay, yeah, on number 7. Page 539, Sutta 64. There is a path, a way to the abandoning of the five lower fetters. That's to becoming one less than an arahat, let alone to being an arahat. Without coming to that path of that way, you shall know as you abandon the five lower fetters. It's not possible. Just as when there's a great tree standing possessed of firewood, it's not possible that anyone shall cut out its heartwood without cutting through its bark and sapwood. So this is the path, the Buddha said, to enlightenment. And you can't get to enlightenment except by that path, no more than you can get to the heartwood of a tree without going through the bark and the sapwood. Number 9. And what is that path, the way to the abandoning of the five lower fetters? Here, with seclusion from objects of attachment, with the abandonment of unwholesome states, with a complete tranquilization of bodily inertia, quite secluded from sensual pleasures, secluded from unwholesome states, a monk abides, enters upon abides in the first jhana. Blah, blah, blah.
It's very clearly stated that without going that path, entering the jhana, you can't get enlightened,
no more than you can get to the heartwood of a tree without going through its bark or sapwood. There's many other places which say similar things. So, the last paragraph. Rahula. That is how mindfulness of breathing is developed and cultivated so that it is of great fruit and benefit. When mindfulness of breathing is developed and cultivated in this way, even the final in-breaths and out-breaths are known as they cease, not unknown. Final in-breaths before you die. They're all known. When the last one stops, everything stops. Be an arahat. That is what the Blessed One said. The Venerable Rahula was satisfied and delighted in the Blessed One's words. Rahula later on became one of the arahats. That's how we meditate. Yeah. It's a good question. It's mostly it's mostly gone, should have really gone at the ninth stage, experiencing the mind. Whole body breath. Well, the breath is part of the body. Yeah, it should be most of it. What usually happens is even that stage, let's say you've got that, the body's over here somewhere. So it's sort of an ache, but you know, it's over there. You can't really feel it. And sounds as well. Sounds are one of the last things to go. You may have sort of the dog bark. You can hear it, but like a million miles away. So you're focused and you've got the breath fully in mind. But other things are just on the edges there somewhere. The same way that I'm focusing on your head now. I can just about see the lady over there. Just about see David and Lee behind you. But not now. This is what happens when you focus in. Yeah. Peace at last. Don't you want to be peaceful at last? That's one of the things which Ajahn Chah used to say, that in his whole life he liked to do things which had an ending. That's why he never liked going to school. You pass one exam, there's always another exam afterwards. Even if you sort of get your PhD, you still have to do another course because someone discovers something new. Or whatever job you have, you always have to go back next week. And even when you retire, you still really have an end. You still got to work at home and work for the Buddhist Society or whatever else you do in your spare time. You want something with an ending to it. And even if you go through this life and you die, you get reborn again. Even that doesn't end. Gee, I mean, can't we actually finish something for once? He said, yes. End the body and the mind. And that's an ending. That's absolutely crazy. How do you say it? You say, well, the Buddha was an arahat. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. So ask him, was the Buddha selfish? Of course he wasn't selfish. And in the Ratana Sutta, Nibbana gaming paramang hitaya. To go to Nibbana. Paramanghitaya means for the ultimate. Paramang is the same as paramount in English. For the ultimate benefit. That's what hitaya means. Well, like the Buddha said, that a man stuck in the mud cannot put another man out who was stuck in the mud. So unless you're enlightened, you can't put out anyone else and make them enlightened. That's sayings of the Buddha. Yeah, that's why I like reading words of the Buddha. If you read the words of the Buddha, this is not words of Ajahn Brahm. You read it for yourself. You see what the Buddha said. And it's amazing that, it's like sometimes in Christianity, for a long time, you could not read the Christian Bible. And it was actually chained in the churches of England, so no one could take it away. And who was that? Was it Wycliffe or something? Someone actually had the temerity to print the Bible and give them out, and they were burnt at the stake for that crime, for spreading the Bible, because people wanted to keep sort of their interpretations. And it's great when you have these books freely available, and you can read it for yourself. So you don't need to follow what Ajahn Brahm says, or what any monk says. Have a look for yourself and make up your own mind. It's called Ahipassika. Come and see. See for yourself. And Pachatang Weditabo Winyuhi. This is, you know, the chant which we always do, every most common chant, Yitipi So chant. Pachatang Weditabo Winyuhi means to be seen, each wise person for themselves. Not to be believed, to be investigated and seen for yourself. So don't believe what I say, don't believe what anybody says. You go and have a look yourself and see what's true. So, there we go. And the books are available in our library at a very reasonable price. And thereby you can read for yourself what the Buddha actually taught. Not what's come down to us through other monks, but what the Buddha actually taught. Okay. I have to go back to a monastery. I haven't got a wife and kids to look after, but I've got many kids. Back in my body, I've got to look after. So let's do the Arahant. We bow to the Buddha and do the Arahant Samma.
Arahant Samma Sambuddho Bhagava Buddhan Bhagavantan Abhivademi Suvakato Bhagavata Dhammo Dhammang Namassami Supatipanno Bhagavato Savaka Sangho Sankhang Namami.